The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
From choir boy to fronting one of the biggest rock bands in the world, my next guest has detailed his musical journey from working class roots, family life, and the audition that changed his life in a new memoir. It's called The Lives of Brian. Brian Johnson, lead singer of AC/DC. Good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Good to be with you again, me son.
I've been reading your book, and I didn't realise that you had such a colourful life long before AC/DC.
Yeah. I think, you know, when I started writing it, you know, I think I just wanted to validate it, you know, because a lot of people thought this guy called Brian Johnson just popped up and joined AC/DC. That was it. And, you know, a lot of them probably wondered where the hell I came from.
Yeah. Now, for people who don't know anything about your musical heritage, and it is an incredible musical heritage, I was trying to count how many bands you were in, because you have at the back of The Lives of Brian a kind of a map of all the outfits you ever belonged to.
Yeah.
And there's loads of them.
Yeah, it was the way it was then, Pat. You know, in Newcastle, you went for a band and you played with them, and then there was another band with better players in, and they'd invite you in, and that's how you worked your way up, because you needed the money to keep the band going, so you'd want to play more clubs. You know, the working men's clubs was our aim, because they paid good money, and it was kind of regular work.
The Nine Pins, the Gobi Desert Band, Half Past 13, Lusika State Group, and so many more. Eventually, of course, you did appear on Top of the Pops with Geordie.
That's right. And Geordie happened, basically, I was working as a draftsman, you got to understand. I was married and a kid. And, you know, what was the old saying, make sure you've got a good apprenticeship behind you before you do anything silly. And I kind of stuck to that. But when Vic Malcolm asked if I would sing with the band, and Vic was one of those guys in Newcastle that was a professional, you know, and he wrote his own songs, which nobody did. We just did cover versions, you know, on the clubs. And then he got to Brian Gibson, and he was noted as, you know, one of the great drummers. And Tom Hill was a great bass player, and performed it. And it was so funny that, you know, he said, we're going to make a record and we're going to take it to London and get signed up. And he said it just like that, you know, and I was going, you'd be lucky. But we did go in, and we recorded two of his songs on a little reel in there. And him and Tom Hill drove to London, walked up these stairs into one of these record companies in Wardour Street. You know, there was an English guy, and they're going, oh, yes, this is absolutely super. And then they came back and banged at my door and gone, yeah, we got it. We've got a deal. And I went, what? He said, we've got to be there Friday to sign the contract. I said, I can't, I'm at work. And that's when the trouble starts, you know what I mean? I had a good boss, and he said, go on. Go down there. He said, mind you, there'll be tears, son. There'll be tears. Oh, you know, it was still a dodgy path to take music, you know.
Now, when you did go on Top of the Pops, you know, this was the show that everyone wanted to be on, the show that was a date with television for everybody, every young person in the country. But you were disillusioned by what you found.
I was awful. The filming was in the afternoon with an audience that was brought in, and the DJs were the stars, or the DJs from Radio 1. They were treated like, you know, big, huge stars, and the bands were just, and you had to mime. I didn't know how to mime, but, you just sing along. And it was so quiet, you know, trying to get out. But it was pretty... It was all corrupt as well.
You tell a story about how you were supposed to re-record the track you were going to do on Top of the Pops with members of the Musicians Union, But of course, that never happened. You brought in your original tape. The guy from your management brought the guy from the union out for lunch, and the tape was substituted for the BBC. So they thought they were getting a BBC union tape. In fact, they were getting your original tape.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no way you can just jump into a studio and completely copy a single in 2 hours. It's just not going to happen. So that was the deal. And it was the deal with everybody. So it was, you know, it was the, you know, the union man had a nice meal.
Yeah. Now, you also mentioned that the host was the DJ, Tony Blackburn, and you said he had all the sincerity of a £4 note.
Yes. Exactly. Well, you know, the week before when it first got played on Radio Pat, I'll never forget, it was one of the DJs came on, you know, the lad with the beard, and he had a program on Friday
Noel Edmonds.
Noel Edmonds, I'm sorry. He had a program on Friday night, which was called The Pick of the Pops. He played about 20 songs or 10 songs that he thought were going to make it, brand new songs that he thought were going to make it. And we were driving to Wales at the time, you know, by that big new Severn Bridge or something, where traffic was horrendous. And he came on Radio 1 in the van, we were sitting in the van, and he said, and he has a song that's very exciting, I really like it. And it's by a bunch of lads from Newcastle, and they're called Geordie. And we just leapt out of our seat. This was the first time we'd heard our song on the radio. And you know, we were elated. And of course, the next morning we're driving back, and then Tony Blackburn was on in his morning show, and he's gone, well, sometimes, you know, a DJ has to play records that he doesn't really like, so yeah, I'm playing this one. And I went, you rotten thing. And it was ours. And I met him in the corridor, the BBC, and I said, oi, you. I said, I wasn't very pleased, and I kind of repeat what I said to him. But, you know, it was an exciting time, but at the same time, it was a bit of a letdown. You know, sure. When you walked out, it was a bit, you know, was that it? Because it looked so good on the screen, and everybody wanted to be on it.
Now, there were obviously more ups and downs and disappointments before AC/DC happened. But going back a bit in time, when you were growing up, where was the music coming from in the house? Was your dad a listener to music? Was your mom a listener to music?
No. We had a Rediffusion radio. You know, it was a council house, you know, obviously surrounded by council houses. And, you know, that the lads in Ireland know exactly what I'm talking about. It was the same stuff. Shipbuilding yards. Ours was collieries. It was all mines, you know. And across the river from my bedroom window, I saw the power station, because Armstrong, the ship-breaking place. There was the gas plant, the flour mill, and Dunstan Staithes, where all the trucks came down from the pits to load up the ships with coal. And in the middle of it all, there was these grey slated houses, Pat, coming down the hill on a place called Scotchwood Road. And it was about 50 streets, and they all looked the same. And it was pretty depressing, the sight, you know. And right at the bottom of our garden, there was the steam trains went by with the coal on to feed the power station. But music was, you know, the Salvation Army used to walk the streets. We would try to listen to radio, the different radios from abroad, but you couldn't hear anything up in the northeast. And we didn't have a record player. So, you know, what started was, I was in the church choir. You know, my scoutmaster, Warren Young, was a Catholic who run a Church of England. And he said, you know, you've got a good voice. So I went, and after 3 weeks, I became head choir boy. So I sort of figured I was a little bit good. I looked dead holy, Pat.
You had to sing in Latin.
Yeah, I didn't have a clue what was going on. But that were very good that wrote it phonetically. So you just had to follow the lines.
Brian, your life had so many ups and downs. Now, at one stage, you joined the Territorial Army Parachutes Regiment. Now, that meant that eventually you're going to have to jump out of planes. But the reason for you joining was much more material.
Oh, yes. It wasn't the real part. It was the territorials. And, you know, and I thought, well, that's not bad. You know, my friend Jimmy Shane came and he said, Brian, I'm going to join the Territorial Army. He said, you get £200 bounty at the end of the year. And I went, that's exactly how much I need to buy a PA system to join, you know, the better bands, because the one I had was a teeny little thing. So off we went, and in Gosforth, there's about four different drill halls. You know, the Fusiliers, the Royal Engineers, you know, all these different things. And we walked in the one, I didn't even look on his path. And we get in there, and the guy said, oh, welcome, lads. Want to join? Go, yes, please. Okay, sign here. And we signed there, and I suddenly realized it was the parachute regiment. I went, oh, I didn't have that. I said, but I thought, they're not going to make a jump out of planes because, well, it's expensive, isn't it? And so 3 months later, there I was in Abingdon and Oxford in a plane, getting ready to jump out. I remember sitting there going, I said, Jesus Christ, you know, I'm high up here. You know, like Paul McCartney and John Lennon and Mick Jagger in London, getting high, but not as high as me, lad. And it was just scary. And but I enjoyed the camaraderie, you know. And I did me thing. I got me PA system. That was important, you know. And I joined this bigger band, and it was really good. And that's what led us to getting into Geordie, because they saw me playing at the better gigs, you know.
Now, of course, you could be a one-hit wonder or a two-hit wonder with a band like Geordie. Just to cut it a bit short, you ended up back living with your parents in your 30s. Your marriage has broken up. I mean, that's a pretty dismal situation to find yourself in.
It was horrible. You know, I'd been playing in front of big crowds and all this, and then, but we'd just been getting paid a small wage, you know, by the record company. And then I got home one night. My wife had found, you know, she was sick of me being gone. She'd found love with a plumber. Who wouldn't? And anyway, so I went back to my mother and father. And it's a little bit depressing when you go home and your mother says, oh, your bedroom's all ready for you. You're going, ooch. You know, and you suddenly look at your suitcase and the belongings that you've gathered over your life, and you suddenly realize it didn't amount to much. But, you know, I never felt sorry for myself. I always jumped in and I picked up that evening's paper and I said, no, I cannot go out and work back because people, you know, people start saying, I thought you were rich. You're on top of the pops. And so I decided to look for something, and there was an advert in the paper, and it said, windshield fitter required. I said, well, how hard can that be? You know, you get your own van, so there's one thing sorted, transport, and you'd be on your own. So this was great. So I went for the interview, which was hilarious in itself, but, you know, the guy looked at me qualifications, and he said, you look overqualified. I said, listen, I just need the job. I got it and all that, and the adventures that followed on that job should have been another book. It was hilarious.
All right, we'll pause there for a moment, Brian, and take a short break and resume our conversation after this.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, I'm talking with Brian Johnson about his new book, The Lives of Brian and So Many Lives There Are. So, you're a windshield fitter. You know, someone has a windshield cracked by a stone or whatever. They make a call and you go out there in your van and you fit a new windscreen on the spot. That was the job.
That was the job. And it wasn't that difficult. And I remember the first morning, the guy said, "And we want you to shadow this guy. This is Norman. And he's going to teach you all the tricks." And I looked over there, and there was this guy there with jam jaw bottom glasses on, with a face just miserable. He did not want to turn, and it was a big lad. And I said, "Good morning, Norman." I said, "Well, that's a good start." And he was the slowest guy I've ever met. I wouldn't go too much into him, but you know, within about 3 months, I was everywhere. And in that time, I remember, Pat, I got a call and it said, "Hey, listen, there's a Cortina Mark IV down by Scotch Corner. They're in a desperate hurry. Can you get there? It's an emergency job." And I said, "Yeah." I said, and off I shook. And there was two guys around the front of it, and they looked different from working people. There was an air of confidence about, you know, they were just, you know, the hair. And I pulled up, and they said, "Oh, thank God." He said, "Listen, we have to get the Hammersmith Odeon for 9 o'clock tonight. It's 3:45. Can you get us a screen in here?" I said, I'll have it in 15 minutes. And they said, "Oh, are you sure?" So I said, "Stand back." Did me business and all that. I'm hoovering all the glass out. And I look in the back, and there's two guys in the back, but I can't quite see. One's got like a straw fedora on. And I get it all done. I said, "There you go, lads. Sorry, but there's a £5 extra charge when it's done on the motorway. So that'll be £30. And he gave us 40, and he said, "Keep the change, mate. You've saved my life." And I went, "There you go." And they were just shooting off. The screeched to a halt, and the window went down. And this skinny arm came up with a T-shirt. And he said, "Here you go." And I ran up, and I went, "Oh, thanks, mate." And I looked in, and it was Ian Dury. And he'd given us an Ian Dury and a Blockheads T-shirt. And as the car went down there, I said, "You know what? I want some more of that. That could be me." I forgot about the excitement of driving up the gigs. Do you know?
Ian Dury hit you with his rhythm stick.
Nicely put, young Pat. I should have written that in the book. Yes, he did. But it was, you know, I said, but by then we'd started a new band called Geordie 2 with different players and three of the best and funniest lads I think I've ever met in my life. And he, you know, it was Derek Rutham, Dave Robson, and Davey Whittaker. And we were good. I mean, we were playing 5 nights a week. There was lines round the clubs to get in to see us. And then by this time, and then I started my own business, which was going well. So it was all wonderful. And I'll show you how funny some of them were. You know, we were in this little miners club. And, you know, we were in the dressing room. I use the term loosely. It was a bit, you know, it was a bass and sink and some steps up to the stage. And Derek Ruthemauer, lead guitarist, he loved things like leopard skin seats in a car and dice hanging from the, you know, he loved all that chintzy stuff, you know. And he was looking at the wallpaper and he said to the concert chairman, he said, "Oh," he said, "this wallpaper's flocked." And the chairman, without breathing, said, "No, it's good for another 2 years yet, son." And I'm sure you're not supposed to laugh at that, but it was that's the kind of things that happened all the time.
Now, all good things come to an end, and come to an end they did, but for a very positive reason. And this is where, can I call her Olga from the Volga, came into your life?
You certainly can, because that's the name I give her. Because I just didn't know who she was. The phone call rang one day, and she went, "You're Brian Johnson?" And I said, "Yes. Who is it?" She said, "You must come to London." I said, "What?" You know, I think it's just the way of talking, you know. "For you are a singer." I said, "Oh, yeah, a singer." "Yes, I am. You must come to London." I said, "Why?" She said, "This I cannot tell you." I said, "Well, I'm not coming down to London if you can't tell us. It's a long way." And she said, you must come down. So you must come down. I said, I'm sorry. What's it about? And she said, it is for a music band. I said, who is it? This I cannot say. I said, well, I'm not coming down. And I hung the phone up. And a couple of minutes later, an old friend of mine said from London, said, Brian, he said, would you come down and sing an advert? And I'd never done an advert before. He said, it's for Hoover. He said, and they pay you well. And by the way, you can still hear it on YouTube.
Well, Brian, we've actually found that. Have a listen.
The new high powered compact from Hoover. It's a beautiful mover. The new compact does more than beat. It also cleans, it also sweeps, and brushes right to the edge. Right to the edge. Changing a bag as easy as ABC. The new high power compact from Hoover. It's a beautiful mover.
Do you know what, Brian? Your voice hasn't changed a bit.
And so I said, oh, sure, I'll come down. When? He said, Monday. And I said, that's the same day as this girl asked us to come down. So I got back on the phone to her and I said, hey, listen, I will be down on Monday. I said, but I must know the name of the band. And she said, I cannot tell you this. And I said, well, I'm not coming. That's no way to talk to somebody. And she said, okay, I will give you the initials. You can figure the rest out yourself. You know, she said, AC on the DC. I said, you mean AC/DC? And she went, scheiße, I have said too much. But I went down there, and, you know, I did the advert for the, well, and I went along and to this studio, I think it was called Vanilla. And there was a bunch of guys, you know, the big double doors, and were playing pool. There was a pool table there, and I threw me 10p on the table and waited for me game, and we were playing away for about a half an hour. And then the tour manager came down the stairs, and he said, hey, has anybody seen this this new singer lad that's coming? And they said, no, well, who is he? He said, he's a Geordie called Brian. And I said, well, it's me. And he said, we've been waiting upstairs for you for half an hour. I said, that's why you should have come down. And I said, up I went. And I was going, oh, well, that's a good start. And I opened the door, and Mal came over with a bottle of brown ale. And he said, you lads like this, don't you? And I went, oh, man, I could murder that. Boy, I tell you, Pat, as soon as this started, I just went, oh, this is in a different atmosphere, this stuff. It was just unbelievable. But I was just pleased enough to be able to say to the boys up in Newcastle, you know, I sang a couple of songs with the AC/DC. It was brilliant. That they were going to be my bragging rights for the next 10 years, you know. Because, when I'd finished, I said, right, lads, I'd better get back home. And they were going, what do you mean? I haven't finished. I said, no, I've got to drive back to Newcastle. It's 5-6 hour drive, mate. And I've got to open the shop, and I've got a gig tomorrow night as well. They were all looked a little stunned and shocked. But the next day, I got a call. So that changed my life, you know.
Yeah. Now, they signed you up to the band, but what is quite remarkable in your book is that you weren't to be on a wage. You were to be a full member. In other words, you shared everything equally with them, you know, even though they had started the band and got it to the stage it was at. You were going to be a full member.
Yeah. And, but at the same time, it wasn't a rich band. You know, I think we're still in debt with the flipping albums because the cost of fortune. And, you know, and they said, you've got to take on the debt as well. And I said, I've got any money. You'll have to take it out me backside if they want anything of me. So, you know, I was signed up but quite happily. You didn't think of money in them days. It was just the joy of, you know, you wanted a decent wage at the end of the week, which they offered me. And I thought, that's more than I've ever seen at the end of any week. They just said, have you got a passport? I said, yes, I do. And they said, good, because we're going to record an album. He said, by the way, can you write lyrics? And I said, yeah, I'll give it a shot. And we got on the plane to the Bahamas, you know, and the rest's history.
the rest is history. Now, in the course of all of this, you had debts, you had the mortgage on the house, and you felt a bit guilty about leaving the band because, you know, even though you weren't making a lot of money, the band was going well, and you even got a few bob to sort them out.
Yeah, oh, I did. But, you know, the thing was, when I went to the band, honestly, you know, I'm not being self-deprecating here, I'm telling the truth. I said to the boys, listen, lads, you know, I kind of turn down an offer like this, I said, but it's not going to last. You know, after a couple of weeks, they're going to figure me out and say, Jesus Christ, you know, he's all fur coat and no knickers, this lad. So we'll figure it, you know. I said, I'll probably be back in 2 or 3 weeks, you know, and we'll get started again. Of course, when that didn't happen, I went to the management and I said, listen, I really feel bad about this. So I tried to get the boys 3 months' money up front. And they did it just like that. And I just felt so good when I got back home and I took the 3 envelopes up there. I said, yeah, guys, I hope that's... And they were just thrilled to pieces, you know, because they were working musicians, you know.
Now, what happened then, I mean, this is March of 1980, you join AC/DC. In just a few short months, Back in Black is recorded. And as you put it at the end of what I think is volume one, you say, the rest is history, because I suspect there's a lot more to come.
That's really, this is where I have a problem, because it's not my book. I think, you know, that book should be written by the boys who were there from the very, very start. You know, otherwise it would be a book about touring. And it's pretty boring, you know, even in Mick Jagger's book, there's hardly anything, Keith Richards' book, there's hardly anything in it about the tours. It's all about, you know, growing up, mom and dad, you know, starting off. Because touring's boring. It's like a 22-hour day of boredom and two and a half hours of just excitement like you've never known in your life. And then back to the hotel. When you were younger, you used to kind of party in, and you know, of course you did. You had a ball. But as the tour has got bigger, you know, more trucks, more crew, more lighting, bigger stages, you know, the fear on the tour manager's face is if anybody in the band wasn't in the lobby at 7:30 on the dot. Well, it was panic. Well, where is he? You know, I'm knocked on his door. Oh, Jesus, you know, because there's 70,000 people in the stadium, you know, and it starts to become, you know, a little serious. And so that's why we look back on the early days, you know, with AC/DC and the days with Geordie 2 and Geordie 1 with great fondness, you know, we loved it. I guess we just didn't realize at the time how lucky we were, you know, to have such fun. We were, some of the things, you know, Phil Lynott. Sorry, I'm just chunking in here. Sitting in a pub with Phil Lynott at the Greyhound in London, and he said, "Hello there, you know, how are you doing, Brian? Have a drink." He said, "Do you have a cassette in your van?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." I said, come on, we'll have a pint. We took our pint out into the van, turned it up loud. He said, this is our new single. And he stuck it in my van, and it was started off the most ethereal guitar playing I've ever. It was beautiful. Diddle-ding, diddle-ding, bom, bom, bom. It was whiskey in a jar. And it finished, and he said, did you like it? And I said, play it again. I said, it was then I realized that and Geordie, we were starting to fall behind these boys. These, you know, these new bands like Nazareth. And I've just learned that Dan passed away yesterday. One of my good pals, Dan McCafferty of Nazareth, singer. And, you know, things like that happened. And, you know, we met a couple of times. Thin Lizzy supported Geordie in Germany and all of that. But that didn't last long. They went on to become... You know, Thin Lizzy, they were great.
Well, Brian, I've really enjoyed reading your book. And even though you say touring is boring, I have a suspicion that you'll have still lots more tales to tell in the next volume. But the current one, with the brilliant title, The Lives of Brian, no title could ever be more true. It's published by Michael Joseph and it's available everywhere. Brian Johnson of AC/DC and many, many bands before. Brian, thank you once again for joining us on the program.
Pat, you're a good man. Thank you so much. The walls were shaking, the earth was quaking, my mind was aching.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.